The Tom Woods Show, episode 2018.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, joined today by Judge Andrew Napolitano, who is the host of his own brand new podcast. And I'm going to just go ahead and ask him about that. What's the name of the podcast, Judge?
Judging Freedom, Tom. And I have to give credit for the name to our mutual friend, Brian Wilson, who came up with it a long time ago, and I sort of resurrected it. And like you, I talk about issues of personal liberty to people who are concerned about government excess. Who isn't concerned about government excess?
Yeah, you would think by now at this point. Well, you have a column, a recent, was this a Washington Times column that I'm reading?
It actually comes out this Wednesday night, so tomorrow evening at 11:59 p.m., but I sent you an early copy of it because I knew it would be of interest to you, and I knew we were going to be doing and recording your podcast today.
Okay, very good. And I think by the time it comes out, we won't be stepping on any toes over at the Washington Times. So it should all work out just fine. So you're talking in this column, well, it's called What Happens When the Government Breaks Its Own Laws. And I learned some stuff here that I guess if I'd been following the news a little more closely, I would have known about things that we just learned about what the CIA and FBI had been up to. Of course, we know now about the torture of detainees. But it's interesting about what has further since been revealed about all this. And a lot of times, the government, rather than come forward with this information, tries to, you know, use all kinds of state secret doctrines to keep it all hushed up. So who knows what else is going on that we don't know about. But what have we, in fact, learned over the past few weeks?
Well, in the past couple of weeks, Tom, and by the way, I have to tell you, it's an absolute delight. I don't know if the audience knows this. You and I are bosom buddies for a long, long time, but it's a delight to be on this podcast, which is so highly regarded internationally, but certainly among people that are concerned about human freedom. And it's a joy for me to work with you, Tom.
Thank you, Judge.
We learned in the past couple of weeks some very interesting things. For the first time in modern American history, a defendant in a criminal case sat in a public American courtroom, a military courtroom, where the prosecutors, by the way, are both military and civilian, and testified to the torture that was inflicted upon him by the CIA. This testimony was given after he had pleaded guilty, and it was part of a sentencing hearing. The government did not challenge any of the allegations of torture, and it was horrific. That's not what I wrote about in this article, but I wrote about it a couple of weeks ago. And it's fascinating that the government didn't challenge it. The jury, which consisted of 8 senior lifetime American military officers, 7 of those 8 wrote a letter to the judge saying the government's behavior was reprehensible and it undermines American values, and the defendant should receive the lowest sentence possible in return for what he went through. We also learned that the CIA, back in the Bush administration, encouraged, facilitated, and paid for torture of these detainees at the hands of foreign intelligence agencies. One of the foreign intelligence agencies was in Poland, and the Polish government is now prosecuting the Polish agents who actually inflicted the torture on the same person who gave the testimony in the courtroom in Cuba. When the lawyers for the Polish prosecutors subpoenaed records from the American military to substantiate the allegations of torture, the Department of Justice elevated the, you pointed this out earlier, the state secret doctrine. Now, the state secret doctrine is a judge-made rule, which basically says whenever the government claims that the revelation of a secret would adversely affect national security, the government doesn't have to reveal it. Now, there's more here than meets the eye, because this doctrine came about by a subterfuge in which the government lied to 12 federal judges, all of whom bought the lie and concocted the doctrine. But it's interesting because the prosecutor for the Justice Department in the Supreme Court, where this case ended up, about whether or not the DOJ has to surrender DOD and CIA records of torture, the prosecutor said to the Supreme Court, well, our ability to maintain state secrets in wartime is enhanced. Whereupon Justice Kavanaugh said, well, what do you mean in wartime? What war are we fighting? Now, this conversation that I'm recounting to you, Tom, took place 3 weeks ago. The prosecutor's response was, we're fighting a war in Afghanistan, in which, of course, the whole court and everybody in the courtroom roared with laughter. And Justice Kagan, hardly an ideological colleague of Justice Kavanaugh, said, are you the only person on the planet who thinks we're still fighting a war in Afghanistan? So I think it's kind of obvious which way that case is going to go. But more and more torture keeps getting revealed in Guantanamo. What was revealed last week and what I wrote about in this week's column was, in order to maintain the attitude that the FBI are the good guys and the CIA are the bad guys in this war on terror, the FBI secretly transferred 9 FBI agents and made them CIA agents for 2 years so that they could engage in torture without besmirching the reputation of the FBI. Now, you would think that this is ridiculous. Torture is torture. It doesn't matter what the title of the torturer is. Apparently, it only matters to the government. We learned this happened in 2001 and 2002, probably with the personal approval of George W. Bush. I say probably because this only happened once before in American history, and it was with the personal approval of President Eisenhower, when FBI agents were transferred to CIA so that they could do things which, as FBI agents, they wouldn't be permitted to do. So kind of a long answer to your question about what we learned. We learned a lot of other things about the FBI, but with respect to torture, this is the most recent that we learned.
Well, as I was reading your column, I got to the part where you say that the way this is all unfolded makes it look as if the CIA are the terrible bad guys who want to torture people, but the FBI have clean hands, and so the FBI are the good guys, and this preserves a certain narrative. But then you say, you know, you point out that the FBI say that they weren't involved in torture, they didn't engage in it. And you're saying, well, did they do this because they just wanted to be able to testify later that they never abused prisoners? And then you say, unless that is, FBI agents were transferred to the CIA and thus stopped being FBI agents so they could engage in dirty deeds without besmirching the Bureau. And I thought, oh, come on, that wouldn't happen.
and then
so your next sentence is, but that's what they did.
Right. I mean, it's absurd the lengths through which the government will go in spending our money and abusing the authority we have given them to cover things up. The interesting question is now, who are these 9 agents? They were never identified. Did they ever testify under oath that they never tortured anybody as FBI agents without revealing to the questioner and the fact finder that they did so as CIA agents? I mean, if an FBI agent admitted he tortured or physically abused a defendant, in most courtrooms in the United States of America, no matter what the defendant did, the case would be dismissed. And FBI agents know this. So the question is, to what lengths did they go to engage in this subterfuge that though they tortured somebody, they technically were not in the FBI at the time they did it? Now, you can't make this stuff up, Tom.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. So another thing in your column involving the FBI has to do with what you describe as the misuse of informants in domestic law enforcement. Now, do you think there is a proper use for informants? And if so, how did the FBI cross the line in the cases you're describing?
The only proper use for informants is by not paying them, which will diminish almost all use of informants, because the FBI has been paying a fortune to them, and they all know this. You want to make some money, and you're involved in group crime, and they've nailed you, go to the FBI, offer to go back to your group of criminals, help the FBI entrap them. You'll make some money and the charges against you will be diminished. Now, if this is a one-off or a two-off or a five-off, I can understand it. But in 8 years, the FBI spent $300 million compensating informants and $42 million a year paying their expenses. So the informant gets his charges reduced, in some cases dismissed, because these informants are all criminals themselves, in return for which the FBI compensates them. And this is the real head scratcher and the most outrageous thing, short of the torture, in this piece. The FBI authorized its informants in a 4-year period to commit 22,500 crimes. I'll repeat that. The FBI authorized, now this information, I didn't dig this up. This is from the Inspector General's report of the Department of Justice. He's an official of the Department of Justice, looked at these records, and he concluded that the FBI authorized its informants to commit 22,500 crimes in a 4-year period. Those are federal as well as state crimes. So we have the issue of federalism. So FBI agents went to state and county prosecutors and said, this guy that you're indicting for bank robbery, you got to dismiss the indictment because he works for us. And of course, they all caved. Oh, works for the FBI? Yeah, of course we will. So who is the FBI to decide what laws should be enforced and what laws should not? And who is the FBI to authorize criminal behavior? Under the Constitution, the president cannot authorize criminal behavior, though we know some have. The Congress can't authorize criminal behavior. They can enact a statute to say something is no longer criminal, but they can't authorize a human being to violate a federal law, and the courts can't authorize this. Yet the FBI does it. It's simply the destruction of the rule of law as we know it. I mean, when the FBI breaks the laws it has sworn to uphold, it becomes a law unto itself. And if the Constitution was written to prevent anything, it was written to prevent that.
Of course, most of these crimes we never find out anything about. Occasionally, there's something very high profile, maybe a case of alleged terrorism or would-be terrorism that's then foiled. It's foiled because they created it in the first place. But I guess probably the best known, or one among the best known of these, was that alleged plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Well, the truth is that the governor of Michigan would not really have been in any danger had the FBI not. So what was the thinking behind this?
I honestly think the thinking was an effort to damage the campaign of then President Donald Trump. He had engaged in a lot of words, harsh words, back and forth with the governor of Michigan, who was a rival to the governor of New Jersey for the most draconian COVID-19 lockdowns. So the time period for this is September and October of 2020. We're at the height of the campaign. The FBI concocts a plot to kidnap her. They engage 18 informants who in turn engage 12 innocent dupes, members of a local militia. So the FBI pays their expenses, and the 12 and the 18, all 30 of them, plot together to kidnap the governor of Michigan. She was in no more danger of being kidnapped than you and I are right now. But the FBI then pulls the trigger, says, we saved you. We saved the governor. Look at how horrible these right-wing groups are. They wanted to kidnap a public official because she's just doing her job. And of course, the 18 plotters that were secretly working for the FBI were not prosecuted at all. The FBI took the credit for saving the governor of Michigan. President Trump looked foolish because of what he had said about her. And I mean, I'm speculating as to their motive. There's no speculation as to what happened. We know there were 30 plotters, 18 of whom were government employees.
Well, I don't hesitate at all to accept your theory here, because when you put it that way, you absolutely cannot exclude the possibility that they would have done this for this kind of reason.
So should the FBI be in the business of creating crimes, period? Should it be in the business of creating crimes to affect the outcome of an election campaign?
Yeah.
I mean, this makes Jim Comey look like sandbox. All he did was make a couple of, and I'm not justifying him, but all he did was stand in front of cameras and make a couple of announcements. These guys spent a fortune and led the governor to believe that she was within inches of being kidnapped in an effort to harm Trump's reelection. Michigan was one of the states that didn't know which way it was going to go. So somebody decided, here's a way to make sure Michigan goes for Biden. Let's entrap some right-wing pro-Trump groups into leading the world to believe that they were going to kidnap this liberal Democratic, off-the-wall, crazy, draconian, lockdown fanatic governor.
I wonder, of course, this is just speculation piled upon speculation, but if she knew that it was all phony from the beginning, if they tipped her off to, again, who can even know? Or if they would have thought the fewer people know, the better.
She's not a stupid person. I'm sure she knows it now. I don't know what they told her at the time. And Tom, this plot was very elaborate. They were going to put her on trial and they were going to keep secret whatever her punishment was. I mean, this is just almost science fiction, the length through which the FBI went to, and I'll say this, to terrorize voters in Michigan to tip the scales of that state against Donald Trump.
Hey, folks, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. This is part of the Tom Woods mission to make you the best possible you you can be. Part of what you are yearning for is getting through all those books you're dying to read, and you just never seem to have the time to do it. And that's where the Blinkist app comes in. Blinkist takes thousands of nonfiction titles and reduces them down to 15-minute blinks, which you can read or listen to. So within an hour, I can be driving around town and consume the equivalent of 4 books. And you will certainly find titles that people like you and me would find interesting. Everything from Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman to For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard, but also old, old classics like The Prince by Machiavelli or Letters from a Stoic by Seneca. And of course, much more recent titles like 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. These are the kinds of books, a lot of times, you say to yourself, I really, really want to read this, but I know for a fact I'm just not going to do it. But I need what's in this book, and that's what Blinkist is all about. And who knows, you sample a whole bunch of books and you may say, well, I absolutely have to read this one and this one because now I've seen just how good it is. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods.
Well, first of all, I guess this column of yours, when it does appear, is going to appear in the online edition of the paper and not behind a paywall so I could link people to it?
Yes. It also, it appears in about 30 venues, one of which is near and dear to your heart and mine, lewrockwell.com. It also appears in the hard edition, the print edition of the Washington Times.
Okay. So I'm going to link to it when it comes out. So tomwoods.com/2018 will have a link to this piece so people can see it for themselves. But I want to, in the maybe 10-ish minutes we have left, shift gears entirely just to ask you some things that I've been curious about. And as you mentioned, we've known each other for a long time. And somehow, over that long time, I never asked you this. And so, doggone it, we're going to ask a couple things. I am curious about what got you into the law in particular, but more generally, what attracted you to the ideas that you and I believe in? And when you went into the law, did you think that you were doing so in the service of those ideas, or were you interested in the law for some other reason? Can you tell us the Andrew Napolitano story?
I have written 10 books on the Constitution. The 10th is not yet published. It's an academic piece on natural law constitutionalism in America. But the first of those books is called Constitutional Chaos, and then it has the same title as this article, What Happens When the Government Breaks Its Own Laws. That is semi-autobiographical, in which I describe my ideological odyssey from conservative Republican to, as our friend Austin Peterson likes to say, True North, Murray Rothbard, Lou Rockwell, Tom Woods, libertarian. So in New Jersey, you become a judge appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. You have the appointment for 7 years. If reappointed and reconfirmed before the end of the 7 years, you have it for life. So I got both my initial appointment and my lifetime appointment by two moderate Republican governors, Tom Kane, the initial appointment, and Christine Todd Whitman, the second appointment. But the folks that went to Tom Kane for my initial appointment were some of the most conservative elements in New Jersey government and in the New Jersey Republican Party, many of whom became somewhat disappointed with me on the bench because of my views that the Constitution means what it says. So quite frankly, watching and listening to prosecutors cut holes in the Constitution to the point where I would say to them, are you talking about the same Constitution that I am? And listening to cops lie about what they did to acquire evidence made me so harshly skeptical of the government. And then I went back and reread so many of the books that I read in high school and college. And it brought me to a view, a Misesian, as in Ludwig von Mises, a Misesian view of the government, that government is essentially the negation of liberty, that liberty is the natural starting point because freedom comes from our humanity. And prosecutors would be furious at me because they would walk into my courtroom and expect to have a leg up, because most judges will give them a leg up. Most judges, Tom, are prosecutors in black robes. And I would say, you know, you two are equal. If anything, the defendant has the leg up, because whatever the statute is under which you're prosecuting him, you got to demonstrate to me not only that it's rational, not only that it's constitutional, but that it's moral. Otherwise, you're not going to prevail. I'm not even going to call a jury. I'm going to throw the case out. Of course, they weren't accustomed to that. So that's really in those years of my life, which for me was a while ago, but it was when I was in my mid-30s. I was the youngest judge in the history of the state, very, very young when Tom Kane put me on the bench. That's when the transformation began. That's about the same time in my life that I met a great human being who introduced you and me to each other, Lou Rockwell.
Wow, that is quite a story. I didn't realize exactly how it had gone and that Lou was a part of this. And that's all great. This is all. But what you just said about prosecutors, I can't help thinking about that Rittenhouse case, because in that case, you had prosecutors who were, let's say, not shedding a lot of light on the reality of what happened. And you got the sense that maybe, as somebody who is not in a courtroom very much, namely me, I should be more open to the possibility, because I don't think about it much. It doesn't affect me. And it's a shame on me for not thinking about it, that maybe a lot of prosecutors are like this, and a lot of them are corrupt, and they just want to win the case, and they'll destroy somebody's life and twist things around. And as Rittenhouse himself said in an interview, what if I hadn't been me, had this big media circus around the case where people could put a magnifying glass on the evidence? You know, what if I was just some whoever, you know, some no-name person right in the, you know, some nook and cranny of America? You know, I could have been railroaded. I mean, so yes. I wonder, how often does that go on?
Every day in every courthouse in the United States of America, Tom. I thought they were trying to railroad him when they charged him with first-degree murder, and it exploded in their faces. I mean, first-degree murder requires planning and plotting. There was no evidence of planning and plotting on his part to kill anybody. First-degree murder requires planning, plotting, and identifying the victim. Well, he didn't know the victims until they went after him. So the government way, way overplayed its hand. But they sometimes do this to terrify defendants and defense lawyers into pleading guilty to a lesser offense. So when Rittenhouse says quite properly, what if I wasn't me? Meaning, what if I wasn't a human being who knew I was innocent and could not be intimidated by the government? What would have happened? Well, if it had been someone of less character, that person probably would have pleaded guilty to something like criminally negligent homicide and would be serving a 10-year sentence. You know, the prosecution in that case was so bad. At some point, I thought they're trying to sabotage their own case. Now, why would the government want to sabotage its own case? Well, this happens. If the government thinks it's losing and it can sabotage its own case. It gets another crack at the defendant. The judge finds out that the prosecutors actually caused the sabotage of the case. Well, they don't get a crack at it. The judge in this case wisely did not rule on the motions for a mistrial because I think he suspected what the jury was going to do, what it did, and it was better for Rittenhouse and better for the whole world if a jury found him not guilty than if a judge threw the case out because of government misbehavior.
Didn't the defense, though, wasn't it the defense that was calling for a mistrial, on the grounds that the video footage they'd been given was not the same that the prosecutors were using and it was grainy and all that? And I remember maybe I just don't know enough about courtroom procedure, but it seems like things are going their way. Why don't they roll the dice on the outcome instead of going for the mistrial?
You know, I'm smiling because that question is always asked whenever the defense asks for a mistrial. The rule of thumb for defense lawyers is at some point prosecutors will get sick and tired of their cases and simply will not want to try them again. But you're right, at that point in the case, when the jury saw a video of the melee out of which these killings occurred, and the defense saw the video and realized that they couldn't see half of what the jury could see because they got a degraded copy, you're thinking to yourself, now, did the government do this intentionally to goad the defense into asking for a mistrial because the government knew it was losing its case and it would try a better case the next time around? I mean, that's the way you think when you've been a judge who's tried, 150 jury trials, you know the prosecutorial mentality. I don't know the answers to these questions. I don't know what was inside the prosecutor's head. I would imagine he's going to be the subject of some disciplinary hearings. I mean, he picked up the AR-15 and put his finger on the trigger and aimed it at a wall in the courtroom. This is like what Alec Baldwin did. He just assumed it was empty. I mean, that is absolutely forbidden under any circumstances, much less giving the defense a degraded version of the evidence. That's called witness tampering. That's what they did to Sacco and Vanzetti, except in the Sacco and Vanzetti trial, it was the judge himself who tampered with the evidence.
In this particular case, I think another factor arguing against going for the mistrial is the state of Rittenhouse's reputation. And I think that a jury finding him not guilty does, to some degree, help to rehabilitate him more than a judge throwing the case out would have.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this judge, notwithstanding his eccentricities, was a wise old bird who knew that. And I think he had a feel. Judges usually have a good feel for which way the jury is going to go. I think he had a feel for which way the jury was going to go. And the gamble that he took, that they would find him not guilty so that he, the judge, would not have to rule on the mistrial, was a wise one to take and better for everybody involved, to be honest with you. If he had declared that mistrial, we'd be going through the same thing all over again.
Yeah.
Probably in the spring.
Yeah. What do you think, leaving libertarian theory out of it? Okay, I just want to know if you were, let's say, if this was your nephew or something, or whatever, like you had some connection to him so that you could advise him, would you say that he ought to, and again, forgetting about libertarian theory here, would you say that he ought to sue some of the high-profile outlets that called him a white nationalist or a white supremacist or whatever?
Yes, yes.
You think he has a chance
of
winning?
You know what he's doing now? Defending himself administratively against left-wing professors at Arizona State University that want him expelled. Expelled? He was found not guilty.
Yeah, yeah. He was found not guilty.
Right. I mean, this stuff will just never end. But I again, taking libertarian theory out of this, whether this is a wise use of the governmental assets, it would be better for him to sue all these people and put their backs to the wall and they'll start coughing up some money and then the cases will go away. But they're going to torment him for as long as they can in little ways like this, like kicking him out of nursing school, which is where I believe he is, at Arizona State University. I just read it in this morning's Times or somewhere that's what he's going through now.
That's crazy. So that proves that real damage was done to him. I mean, sometimes it can be hard to win a defamation case because, well, I mean, certainly for a public figure, but he's not a public figure. He's just a kid. But it's, you know, you have to prove that it actually did you some damage. Well, it's like the people who hate him so much they can't help themselves. They're handing him the evidence. If they're trying to throw him out of college, they're handing him the evidence.
Correct. Well, defamation is a strange bird in the law. I mean, opinion is protected. So if it's clearly an opinion and you state the basis for the opinion, it's absolutely protected. He is a public figure, at least he is now, because he's a household name. He was not a public figure when this started. You know, defamation law started out with public official. A police commissioner in Montgomery, Alabama, his name was Sullivan, Times Against Sullivan, and then it migrated to a public figure and then public person. And you can even have what's called a limited public person status, where your public persona is limited just to a certain area of human behavior. But he is clearly a public figure, meaning he would have to show that when Joe Biden, for example, and suing the president is fruitless, but whoever he's going to sue, said he's a white nationalist, they said it knowing that it was untrue or with reckless disregard for the truth. But you're right. The more they say about him and the more they do to him, like these characters on the faculty at ASU, which is interesting because it's a government-owned school, so he has even more protection on the ASU campus than he would on, say, the Princeton or the Columbia campus. The more these people throw things at him, the stronger is his case against them. You can't make this up.
Yeah.
You can't make up what the FBI did becoming CIA agents. You can't make up the FBI allowing people to commit crimes. And you can't make up what the left is now trying to do to torment this kid after he was found not guilty, totally exonerated by a jury.
And then when this is all done, 30 years down the road, the updated American history textbooks are written. It's almost like we know for a fact that the real story of Rittenhouse will not be told. We know there are a whole bunch of things. The COVID story will be told all wrong. We can almost guarantee this. So I really think there is. Now, I'm too tired from writing books, but I appreciate, Judge, that you just keep on doing it. I haven't got the energy for it anymore, but we need some young whippersnapper. Somebody's got to step up and write the secret history of the 21st century that's sitting there right in front of you. You don't even have to dig through old documents or anything. It's sitting there right in front of you, all the evidence for it. So all the major episodes of the 20th century, whether it's the financial crisis or the war in Iraq or Rittenhouse or COVID or all these major things that you know for a fact the textbook is going to get wrong, somebody could get rich telling it right if they have the ambition to sit down and write it.
And the bottom line is this dirty little secret that everybody in the government, politicians, lawyers, and judges all know. Every day, the government breaks the law and gets away with it. Every single day.
Yeah, yeah. And every single day in the government schools, kids are taught a version of how the courts work that is so far removed from the reality that they come out with a completely cartoonish understanding of the world.
Yes.
So anyway, I want to encourage people to check out your brand new podcast, Judging Freedom, which you can find on all the podcast apps that you guys like to use. So check that out and support the judge. Judge, thanks for your time today and best of luck on the new venture.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom. And I hope you'll come on Judging Freedom soon. All the best to you. Thank you.
All right, folks, that's it for today. Coming up later this week, I've got the publisher of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s brand new, devastating new book on Dr. Fauci. It's a stunning book, a stunning book. And we're going to talk about not so much the contents of the book, but the various obstacles the publisher has faced, all the nuttiness around, you know, that occurs when you take on somebody like Dr. Fauci head on. You take on the establishment, the established way of thinking. Well, you can imagine the nightmare it's been, but they've still managed to have a tremendous amount of success with that book. So we're going to talk about that. And then our old friend Matt Kibbe comes back to the show. I haven't had him on for a long, long time. I did reproduce an episode, or for one of my episodes, an interview I did with him as the interviewer at Porkfest this year. But we'll have Matt come back on because he's just written something called Pandemic Socialism. So we're going to look at the economics and some of the government power behind what's been going on over the past couple of years. So a couple of really, really juicy episodes coming up. And then Matt Ridley, who's been a guest a number of times, the great British author and, I don't know, polymath, I guess I might say, is coming back and to talk about his brand new book on the origins of the virus and a heck of a lot more. So a lot of stuff to look forward to. If you like and appreciate what's going on here, I would be very grateful if you join me as a supporting listener. You get a great many benefits, not least of which is membership inside the Tom Woods Show Elite, where the cream of the crop can be found. That's where you belong. Check it out at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.